Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, Yasha Levine will join us from St. Petersburg, Russia, to talk about a fascinating piece he wrote for The Baffler called From Russia with Panic. And Yasha Levine talks about the latest rage of accusations here in the United States about Russian involvement in the 2016 election. And he takes us back to 2008 and the brief war that happened in Georgia with its breakaway republic, South Ossetia. The Russians got involved, and there were hacking events that occurred there. And Yasha Levine draws some interesting parallels to today's situation. I'd like to thank Paul Elsesser, Mark Lewis and Kathy Burwell, John Zweibel. They are deep, deep pocket supporters of the Peter B. Collins podcast, and I appreciate them greatly. I invite you to join in. You can help support my work. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then click on Become a Subscriber, and you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or $50 annual subscription. Don't forget, for just $2.99, you can buy the Peter B. Collins app in the Apple App Store. And thank you for your support. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, Yasha Levine returns from Russia.
From Russia with love, I fly to you.
Yasha Levine has graced our podcast before, a writer for Pando here in Silicon Valley. He's working on a book called Surveillance Valley. He is currently in St. Petersburg, Russia, and he just published a piece last week in The Baffler, a lengthy, printed out to 15 pages, a lengthy piece called From Russia with Panic. Yasha Levine, always great to talk with you. Thanks for joining me today.
Always good to be on. Thanks for having me.
And you are actually in St. Petersburg, Russia. That's where you've decided to edit your book, Surveillance Valley. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. So I'm here in the center of St. Petersburg, actually overlooking the River Fontanka. If any of your listeners have been here and know what that is, that's sort of the secondary river that runs through the city.
Mm-hmm.
It's really beautiful. And it's frozen.
I want to establish a couple of things quickly. You are of Russian ethnic background. You're an American citizen. And we're going to talk about some of your reporting in Russia going back about 8 years or so. But I also want to establish a fact here, and that is that there are currently estimated to be 148 million citizens of Russia, the Russian Federation. And frequently in the corporate media and our political leaders these days, we just blame Russia in general, and Russia hacked our election, and Russia did this, and Russia did that. And it is so imprecise and maddeningly vague to just say, oh, Russia did it. And of course, by implication, we mean the Russian government, we mean the Russian intelligence agencies, we mean Vladimir Putin personally. But this lazy use of the term Russia to basically be the boogeyman for all ills in America today, it drives me up a wall, Yasha. So let's start there. when you see these broad descriptions blaming Russia for this or that, how do you react?
I mean, if it was only Russia, if it was just Russia, and we were talking about a geopolitical conflict of some kind, and Russia as a country, I would maybe react a little bit neutrally, a little bit more neutrally. But the problem is that the way that this is covered in the media, is that it's not just Russia, but it's about Russians, you know. And when you talk about Russia, you're talking about there. It's not just a country, but you're talking about a kind of a national character almost. You know, there's almost no differentiation between modern Russia, the post-Soviet Russia, right? Mm-hmm. The Russia that that emerged in the early 90s, and you know, the Soviet Union. And there's no difference between the Soviet Union, maybe the Tsarist government that came before that, and kind of the serf mentality of the people there, and their, you know, and their total subservience to the Tsar, you know, to this really, really autocratic leader. You know, so there's a weird kind of, I'd say kind of an Orientalist thread that runs through coverage of Russia and discussion about Russia and Russians and Russian hackers or alleged Russian hackers. It's not just about a country, right? But it's about a kind of a national character, and it's a very sneaky kind of character. It's a slavish kind of character. It's a character that is, you know, can't ever be trusted. You know, right. whether they're communist or Putin supporters or whatever they are, or they're, you know, Orthodox Christians or something. I mean, so you have this kind of, I mean, it is racism. I mean, it's just because Russians are generally considered white. And they are white. They're Slavic. I mean, it's a multicultural, very multi-ethnic nation, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. With a large Muslim population, and you know, you have a lot of Buddhists. I mean, it's a really diverse place. It became less diverse after the collapse of the Soviet Union, but still. But there is a kind of you know, it's all tinged with a type of racism, right? And a type of
Yasha, I see it as almost cartoonish, and the cartoons are laden with Cold War coded messages, and some of the send-ups that are in feature films. You know, the Russians have been the bad guys in a lot of American movies, even after the deconstruction of the Soviet Union. And you know, I'm giving away my age here, but the cartoons that I remember were the subplot of Rocky and Bullwinkle with Boris Badenov and his beautiful and much taller wife Natasha.
Yes.
And we really do reduce so much of the discourse. And whether it was, hatched by John Podesta and Neera Tanden for the benefit of the Clinton campaign, let's blame Russia. Everybody thinks they're bad. Or the spooks who have, helped propel this whole arc of a narrative with zero facts. Starting back in October with that bizarre press conference that was held by the head of the National Intelligence Agency at the time, James Clapper, then the fact-free memorandum that was delivered to President Obama on January 6th of this year with blank pages, and then the bizarre addendum with attacks on the RT network. And here my Boris Badenov reference comes into play. The CIA projected the influence of RT in America the same way that Boris Badenov used to use a flashlight to make his shadow look tall and menacing.
Yeah.
Your turn.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. What's interesting is that, early on, and pretty early on when she was, when Hillary started running against Trump and Trump won the nomination, I mean, Hillary Clinton really essentially started running against Vladimir Putin. I mean, that was her strategy. You know, so she equated him, right, with Vladimir Putin, even kind of before the hacks and the Russian hacking hysteria really took off. You know, I mean, so she was running on essentially a kind of a Cold War reboot, where Trump was a Manchurian candidate and he was untrustworthy. He couldn't be trusted with the presidency, and because of his he praised Vladimir Putin because Vladimir Putin supposedly praised Trump, you know, so it was this thing. So, you know, this whole campaign, you know, even before Trump won, was essentially revolved around a kind of a zombie idea of what Russia is, you know, a zombified idea, and a kind of a Cold War zombie that was dug up, you know, and really, I mean, it has gotten worse from there. So, you know, it's kind of amazing that, you know, Hillary Clinton had, you know, completely substance-free campaign, but maybe the only substance that she had was that she hates Russia and that Russia is an evil. And Russia is an evil that has to be destroyed.
And we had Obama stoking this in his second last news conference before he took his last subsidized vacation in Hawaii. He looked at the camera and he said, who would you rather believe, our intelligence community or the Russians? And it's like, those are the only two choices, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so let me also get you on get your comment on this before we dive into your article. And that is, if Obama and Clinton and Podesta and all of the Democratic leaders truly believed that Russia tilted the election and gave it to Trump, why on earth did they allow him to take office? They had several ways. They didn't participate in the Green Party-funded recounts that did show substantial election fraud, particularly in Michigan. They didn't participate in the challenges at the Electoral College, which is the system that, if it actually worked, was designed to prevent the rise of a demagogue. And then they were all silent when about 10 members of the House of Representatives filed formal objections to the certification of the election of Donald Trump, and not a single Democratic senator would second those objections to throw it into this kind of a post-election dispute. And so they all sat back, content to have some future commission determine whether or not this actually happened. And they claim they know. They claim that they've got this intelligence that the agencies will not share with us. And therefore, they know that this actually happened, and they didn't do anything to block his rise to power. I simply don't find those two things reconcilable.
Well, I think, Peter, is because you haven't considered one obvious thing, is that I think, obviously, President Barack Obama, you know, and the CIA, the NSA, U.S. Naval Intelligence, all those are essentially Putin's Manchurian candidates, because why wouldn't they have acted, right? I mean, if it's so obvious, why wouldn't they have acted to remove Trump or to prevent him from taking office? I mean, there's only one answer, is that everybody is a fucking Putin Manchurian candidate. You know, it really is. Or Obama's a traitor, and everyone who served under him and let this happen is a traitor. You know, so there's basically two theories, right? And neither of them are really like a good look for the previous administration, right? I mean, if you were to take this at face value, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't believe either one. You know, I don't believe that the entire Obama administration was under the control and sway of Vladimir Putin, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe that, you know, Obama is a traitor in this regard. I mean, what it is just bullshit. and it is a way of it's a way of using this kind of foreign, you know, threat, right, to justify and to explain the failure of the Democratic Party and the failure of a kind of a neoconservative foreign policy view, without actually having to deal with the consequences, or having to actually deal with your own failure and having to admit it and having to have some kind of a shedding of the old guard and an emergence of something new, you know. So I mean, it is basically a way for the old guard to stay in power.
Mm-hmm.
And so you create or you inflate the outside threat, and you use it to explain everything. And look, I mean, let's just be clear here. You know, I if I was the Russian government, you know, and if I had, you know, maybe I would try to throw the election to Donald Trump. I mean, there's no evidence, but I don't put it past the Russian government. You know, I mean, this is what governments do. This is what governments who are kind of powerful do to each other, right? They play that game. You know, America plays that game. America has played that game for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Russia played that. The Soviet Union played that game very well as well. And so I don't see it as something that is completely outside the realm of the possible, right? But we need in a democratic system in which we live in America, we need to have some kind of proof that we as citizens can can look at, can judge for ourselves, and can make our own decisions. We cannot rely on these opaque sort of intelligence sources which have deceived us so often in the past and have led us really down into horrible things. And so, you know, I think everyone still has very fresh on their minds, you know, how America was duped into supporting the Iraq War and the, you know, Iraqi Freedom. And it's pretty obvious if you kind of peel away the if you try to depoliticize this a little bit, it's very obvious, and it's you know, if you use a little common sense, you can kind of pierce through the bullshit or begin to pierce through the bullshit and to understand that, you know, if to make any kind of decision, we need information. We need something to hold on to, something to use, something tangible. And we have been given nothing. And so the more time that goes by and as this evidence that's supposed to be there, you know, keeps not emerging and is, again, just not there, the more I begin to think that, you know, it is all just either complete bullshit or that intelligence services essentially don't want to give up the information because they don't want to compromise some kind of source. But even that doesn't make much sense. Because if you were to burn the source, this would be the time to do it, right? Yeah. Even if it means, you know, even if it means endangering the lives of 1,000 people. Or, you know, even, I mean, you know, I don't want to be callous here, but, you know, what does a you know, CIA guy care about the lives of 1 million people in a different country, let's say? You know, I don't think that very much. And so, but if it's just, you know, to protect the integrity of your republic, right, from a takeover by a foreign government, you'd burn that. You'd burn as many people as it took to burn to prevent it from happening, right? And so, you know,
Okay. Now, Yasha, in your piece From Russia with Panic, let me just get the time when you submitted to the Baffler for publication, because I believe you completed this before Vault 7 was released by WikiLeaks. Am I correct?
Yes.
All right. And you stated in here, and this is something that anybody with some sense of computer science knows, and you studied at UC Berkeley in computer science, and that is that you can mask the origin of an IP address. And I've been talking about this for years. My sources at the NSA, Bill Binney and others, have confirmed what we know. And that is that there are many ways to use different devices to simulate an IP address so that you can blame somebody else for the hacking that you're doing. And so you wrote in your piece, the moral of the tale is that cyber warfare is a fraught and high-stakes theater of conflict in which the uncertain nature of cyber attack attribution can be exploited to support any politicized version of events that one chooses. So with the release of Vault 7 and the disclosure about Umbridge, which I believe uses some sort of Russian-created code to make it look like Russia did a hack when somebody else did it. And this has been, known since CrowdStrike first announced with great clarity and assertion that their investigation of the DNC server confirmed that the attacks had come from Russia. And so talk a little bit about this, because some people, like the audience at Fox News, are just discovering all this for the first time.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, you know, there's an interesting kind of fight that's been happening throughout this sort of Russian hacking scandal, right, within the cyber security, cyber attribution business. And on the one side, you know, there's a camp, and it's kind of the dominant camp, or at least the loudest camp, and sort of the camp that's closest to power, and the camp that's really kind of pushing this idea that they have the evidence that Russia pulled it off because they have some kind of signature that they've identified, and they can, you know, with almost near certainty, you know, show that it is the Russian government or is linked to the Russian government. And the other camp that says, look, you know, yes, you found some code and you can link it to some kind of other Russian operations, maybe. But that code, you know, once it's used in the field, it can basically be stolen and repurposed, discovered, hacked, and then kind of redeployed. And then when it's redeployed by potentially a different intelligence agency intelligence agency from a different government altogether, it can then be used to mask sort of the origin, and that can be used to sort of create a fake signature, a false sort of like breadcrumb that breadcrumbs that are left to signify that someone else has actually pulled off the hack, or someone else used that piece of malware, right, to get into a server. And so, you know, yes, so there's a kind of a debate between a kind of an absolutist kind of camp that says, no, there are these kind of state actors, right? And their intelligence agencies kind of develop these tools in-house, right? And they never let them go, right? If it's Russia, or Russian intelligence services are, you know, develop these specialized tools to essentially inject malware into target host computers, right?
Right.
And then they reuse that code, but no one else uses that ever. And so once we can sort of identify that piece of code that is used on these targets, then we can be sure, you know, be almost certain that whatever the next target is hit is definitely going to be the Russians, right? So if they hit, you know, a bank in Georgia, if they hit a bank in Latvia, if they hit, like, you know, NATO headquarters, or they tried to penetrate NATO headquarters, if someone did, we can say, okay, that's probably the Russians. So then the Russians are using this kind of code and using this kind of approach to try to get into these systems. Then we can say, oh, the same kind of code was used to try to hack the DNC. So that must mean that it is the Russians. So that's one camp, right? And then there's another camp that says, no, well, look, once a piece of malware is used in the world, right, even if it was developed by, you know, the FSB, let's say, if they developed it and they used it against a target, once it gets out, you know, it could be essentially captured and reappropriated by somebody else. And then, so once that happens, you know, all bets are off. It could be anybody. And so we have to be a little bit more skeptical, you know, when we are doing these attributions. That's the other camp.
And Yasha, and so I think with this in mind, when we carefully read the October 7th statement from James Clapper, which was then exaggerated to be a statement from 17 American intelligence agencies.
Yes.
All they said was that these hacks are consistent with those that we have observed from Russia in the past. And that allows for any, a range of different actors who might have used tactics that are consistent with Russian tactics. But that doesn't prove that Russia was responsible.
Yes, no, it doesn't. It just means that here's what that means, all right? That means that, you know, over the past 10 years, they've observed a kind of a similar sort of, behavior pattern on behalf of some kind of group. Now, they can't even tie it to an intelligence agency. They just know that these targets have been hit in similar ways, you know? And this pattern might last, you know, for 10 years. And it might involve, you know, thousands of targets all over the world. And they might actually not really have that much in common with one another. But somehow, some kind of like cybersecurity or cyber forensics firm like FireEye or CrowdStrike attributed those attacks to the Russian government or to groups associated with the Russian government. And so all that James Clapper is saying that, you know, we have attributed these really kind of nebulous attacks to the Russian government. And so we're going to keep attributing them to the Russian government because we attributed them to the Russian government in the past. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, because they don't provide any evidence to back this up, we can't make an actual, you know, evaluation of how they are arriving at this conclusion. All we can sort of see is how they've arrived at this conclusion before. And if you study that, we study the ways in which the cyber forensic firms actually do their investigations. I mean, it's comical. I mean, it's a joke because these, look, we can maybe back up. You know, there's basically two groups, right? The Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear that are implicated in the hacking of the Democratic Party, including Podesta's email, his Gmail account. Now, if you actually look at what these groups are, you realize that there is no Cozy Bear and there is no actual Fancy Bear. These are just names that were made up out of thin air by CrowdStrike,
mm-hmm.
right? and so they are normally known as APT-28 and APT-29, which are, again, these kind of groupings, right, that are again made up by cybersecurity researchers to try to kind of put an identity, to try to group attacks that seem similar against, you know, hundreds and sometimes thousands of targets, try to group them into kind of one bucket and say, okay, these attacks use the same methodology, have kind of similar tools, and have kind of a similar profile that we can say with some certainty that they might be attributed to one group, right? And so from there, and the way that they say that, so these are two groups that have been sort of identified over the past maybe 5 years by cybersecurity researchers. Now, a lot of cybersecurity firms don't, you know, say that they can say with any certainty that they are tied to Russia. Others like FireEye and CrowdStrike do say that they are tied to Russia. And how do they connect these groups to Russia? Well, they use some really interesting metrics. For instance, so like the fact that, you know, APT-28, which I think is Cozy Bear, and APT-29 is Fancy Bear, they are tied to Russia because when they look at like the time when the attacks happen, right? Or when the software that is written that to carry out the attacks, mm-hmm. and compiled in a compiler on a computer, it happens in a time zone that during the work day, right? In the time zone that can be linked to Moscow. So basically, we know that it is tied to the Russian government because these things were compiled and people were doing work on them while during a typical work day in Moscow.
Well, I mean, we know the rigid union rules there at FSB. You can't work at night or on the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, what kind of self-respecting hacker works on a work day, you know? And of course, you know, even if we take it at face value, right? It's okay, well, you know, these guys do work for the government, you know, pretty strict. You know, you got to clock in, you got to clock out. Okay. Well, hey, you know, that zone that includes Moscow is actually a very wide time zone, you know, because you can go, you know, a couple of time zones to the west, mm-hmm. you know, and you can go a couple of time zones to the east. And so if you look at that, that basically includes most of Africa, you know, a good chunk of Europe, just about the entire Middle East, you know. It includes also Ukraine, which has a lot of Russians. It also includes, you know, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary, you know, includes most of the Balkans, you know, and so you kind of left with this kind of ridiculousness, right? So they're like, okay, we know it's Russia because we can tie it to the Moscow time code.
Right, yeah.
But then the Moscow time code is just so huge as to be completely, you know, just, you know, ridiculous. It's not something that would stand up in court. Let's put it this way.
And Yasha, I just need to interject here that in all of this, the U.S. media and our political leaders never acknowledge the aggressive, offensive cyber activities that the U.S. itself is doing on a daily basis.
Oh.
And I'm sure that it doesn't just happen between 9 and 5 Beltway time.
Well, so, you got to figure out, yeah, I mean, they're, you know, actually, look, you're right, because a huge, so a lot of the cyber offensive stuff happens from San Diego, from the naval base there. And so, you know, you got to be on the time zone. So they're basically, you could be a hacker, you know, you could be a Russian, you could be an American hacker,
mm-hmm.
because you're on the Pacific time zone, right?
And I'd
Pacific Standard Time.
I'd use the handle Yankee Pete just to really fool them, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, you'd be like, you know, no, I know. It's look. I mean, you know, I think your readers would like this, because I mean, just here's. So this is a kind of an explanation from a very respected cybersecurity firm called FireEye, which is CrowdStrike's sort of wealthier, bigger competitor, mm-hmm. right? And this is how they tie one of the two groups that is, you know, accused of sort of infiltrating the DNC, APT-29 or Cozy Bear. How they attribute it to Russia, and this is one of the reasons. There's two main points, and this is one of them. Quote, we suspect the Russian government sponsors the group because of the organization's targets and the data it steals. Additionally, APT-29 appeared to cease operations on Russian holidays, and their work hours seem to align with UTC+3 time zone, which contains cities such as Moscow and St. Petersburg.
Oh, man. What bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, that time code, that time zone, essentially, it has like, you know, probably like 50 countries in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's definitive. That really is. Now, Yasha, I want to give people a taste of your article, and I'm going to link to it at Baffler's website. But you provided something that the American media rarely does, and that is a little history and a little context. And in 2008, you covered the conflict in Georgia as the breakaway Republic of Georgia, a former Soviet republic, was trying to crack down on separatists in South Ossetia. And explain what was going on there and the role of different alleged cyber offensives that were occurring during this conflict where Russia got involved.
In 2008, in summer of 2008, actually the day that the Summer Olympics opened up in Beijing, in August 7th, 2008, there was a war broke out on Russia's border, on Russia's southern border. The war was kind of this really has really deep roots, old roots, and it was between Georgia and South Ossetia. So Georgia is, you know, a former Soviet republic, and South Ossetia is a kind of a breakaway republic from Georgia. It is ethnically different from Georgia. It's has about Ossetians make up roughly 2/3 of the population there, and it had a really kind of bitter and bloody history with Georgia, which is a kind of a pretty nationalist nation. And in the early 90s, when you know all these different sort of republics were breaking away from Russia and from the Soviet Union and were declaring independence, Georgia declared its independence, and then South Ossetia declared its independence from Georgia. And so, you know, it was this kind of, this happened all over the Soviet Union, and it was a really bloody time. And what happened was there was a short war between the two. South Ossetia prevailed, and it was kind of, and the conflict became kind of frozen in time. So Georgia never really fully accepted the independence of South Ossetia, right? And so it considered that part, that territory, part of Georgia proper. And so, but there was this kind of really hostile peace that had kept for over a decade, for 15 years. And that peace was broken again when Georgia invaded South Ossetia. And so, you know, I covered that war. And at the time, you know, it was kind of a kind of a peak sort of at that for that time, Russian hysteria and anti-Putin hysteria in the West. You know, it was another election season. So now it was it's 2008. So I think Obama had just won the primary, or Hillary had just conceded the to Barack Obama, and so Barack Obama was kind of squaring off against McCain, the Republican nominee for the presidency, and you know, and Russia was really kind of at the fore of this of their campaign, and so
and Yasha, let me just interject that. John, sure. It was exposed that John McCain's national security advisor was a paid consultant to the government of Georgia and Mikhail Saakashvili.
Yes.
And that kind of parallels what we're learning now about Mike Flynn, a paid foreign agent for a company that fronts for the Turkish government. and so there's a bit of deja vu in some of these events. So proceed and tell us a little bit about how this devolved into a cyber war, because you say when war broke out, a slew of Georgian websites came under attack, the central bank was hacked, and also a Russian language forum called Stop Georgia suddenly came online, hosted from the United States.
Well, yeah, I mean, so look, there was a cyber component to this war. The war was very short. It lasted only about 5 days. So what happened was because Georgia attacked South Ossetia, but South Ossetia had peacekeeping troops. You know, there were South Ossetian, Georgian, and Russian peacekeeping troops in South Ossetia. And South Ossetia had become a kind of de facto part of the Russian Federation. And so Russia basically counterattacked, right? And repelled the Russian invasion, the Georgian invasion, and you know it was a kind of a very, it was a humiliating defeat for Georgia. I mean, really humiliating. I mean, you know, you had the Georgian president on live television cowering, you know, as Russian jets flew over by at some, you know, while he was doing his interview with the BBC. He was seen on TV eating his tie. I mean, actually eating his tie. He was so nervous because it was supposed to be such an easy, it was supposed to be a cakewalk, you know, and he was really kind of convinced that he could invade South Ossetia, take it back, and it would be like done with in a second. But in reality, he got completely crushed by Russia. And it was the first kind of, for Russia, it was the first war that it had won, really, you know, since the Soviet Union collapsed. And so what happened during this short war was that there was a cyber component, you know, which was that Georgian websites came under attack. And some Russian websites came under attack as well. RT was actually taken offline sporadically for a few days. And a bunch of Russian Georgian websites came under attack, and that was a kind of a really small part of the war. I mean, it was inconsequential, really, because Georgia was a really poor country, and at the time it had you know, among the lowest sort of rates of internet connectivity in the world. So I mean, you know, attacking its internet infrastructure didn't really have an effect on its military capability, right? But you know, but what happened was, it was a really complex conflict, right? That to really understand it, you'd have to unravel essentially centuries of inter-ethnic kind of warfare and conflict and politics in that region, which is kind of like the Balkans. You know, I mean, South Ossetia sits right next to Chechnya, and it's in the Caucasus and so it's a really kind of a really difficult region because it's been at war with itself for centuries, even without Russia's sort of intervention in it.
And Yasha, tell me if you agree or not, but I would overlay the NATO component here, that after the bust up of the Soviet Union, that the U.S. used NATO to try to isolate Russia by recruiting countries like Georgia and Ukraine into the NATO and European orbit. And I submit that this is the critical part of the story that the U.S. media fails to cover, fails to share with people to understand why Putin decided that he needed to grab Crimea.
Yeah, I mean, yes. Yes, I mean, the NATO expansion, I think, is a big one, you know, and Georgia, really, in Mikhail Saakashvili. Look, Mikhail Saakashvili, you know, everything in the world really boils down to local politics, right, or domestic politics. So, you know, most wars or most conflicts can be explained if you actually look at the domestic political situation, right? And so, because, you know, it's just foreign wars are an extension of domestic politics. And so, you know, in Georgia, you know, Mikhail Saakashvili, who was a kind of came to power in one of the first color revolutions in the region. He went to school in Columbia University in the States. He was this really kind of a Western darling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, Georgia was a kind of a long-term project for neoconservatives in America as part of a bigger project to peel away former Soviet republics from the Russian sphere of influence. And it was really kind of one of the first and most successful ones. And so Mikhail Saakashvili was, you know, held up as this kind of golden boy, as a Western reformer, someone who would take Georgia away from kind of Russian influence and Soviet influence, right, and bring it to the West. But what happened with him domestically, right, was that he became even more authoritarian than the pro-Russia president that he and the government that he replaced. Mm-hmm. And actually about a year before less than a year before the invasion, you know, internally the political situation got really bad because there were opposition protests to him, and his government cracked down in a very brutal way, in a way that hadn't been seen in that country for, I don't know, maybe since the Bolshevik Revolution. You know, I mean, he closed down oppositional. He raided a TV station that was kind of in the only opposition TV station in the country. He, you know, the Human Rights Watch, you know, issued reports condemning his government, right, mm-hmm. for the crackdown on free speech and protesters. Really bloody kind of confrontation that happened there. Anyway, and so this is the Western boy, this is the golden boy that's supposed to have, you know, brought democracy to Georgia. And so, you know, for Mikhail Saakashvili, this war that he kind of he inflamed, that has been kind of simmering there for over a decade. You know, it was really a kind of a way of masking an internal domestic problem, right? Political problem to his own power. And he was being challenged, and it was clear that he was going to be out in the next election, right? And so he was really wanted. Yes, he lobbied for Georgia to be included in NATO right before this. And so yes, he was really, and you know, Condoleezza Rice came out to Georgia right before the war broke out. You know, the U.S. held military exercises on the border with Russia, or right before this war broke out. And so,
and
you know,
Dick Cheney wanted to send a strong message to Moscow with some American bombing raids or some sort of intervention there, which was highly risky at the time.
Well, I mean, look, yes, I mean, so Saakashvili, I think, naively believed that if he attacked Russia and kind of threw South Ossetia, went after Russia and did this confrontation, that America would back him. And, you know, and Dick Cheney, yes, he wanted to bomb Russian troops, essentially, a limited, targeted kind of bombing to close a tunnel that connected South Ossetia to North Ossetia and allow kind of reinforcements to come in on the ground, because it's a highly mountainous region, very hard to get around. So there's one really, really long tunnel called the Rocky Tunnel that connects South Ossetia to North Ossetia, and North Ossetia is kind of part of Russia, part of the Russian Federation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, like, look, you know, and Bush, you know, bless his heart and bless his soul, you know, smartly kind of said, no, Dick, you know, we're going to not do that right now. We're just going to see what happens. And so, you know, and so actually George Bush, he didn't know what to do. He was afraid, and he didn't do anything. And so that was, in the end, a good thing.
Well, his hawk wings had been clipped. That's how I'd put it.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he could have gone out in a fireball, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe he wouldn't have a comfortable retirement like he does now, painting. Because, I mean, it would have triggered a war with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure of that. And you know, Russia is a nuclear power. We might have not even be having this conversation right now if Dick Cheney had his way.
And let me quote again. Let me quote again from your article, Yasha Levine. To be sure, the assaults were troubling. Hacks against Georgian websites took place. They were in some way connected to the war, and Russia's cyber criminal world had ties to the country's security establishment. But it was an enormous and dangerous leap to interpret these attacks as a pre-planned Russian intelligence operation, possibly justifying an American military response. So with that said, historically, does that apply, in your view, to the current imbroglio over these, swirling accusations about Russia manipulating our 2016 election?
Very much so, and that's why I wrote the piece. You know, I mean, look, at the time, people were looking for an easy answer, right, to who to blame in this conflict, right? And cyber warfare seemed to offer a very clear-cut, easy-to-understand case. So what happened was that, you know, in the days leading up to the war, a couple of Georgian websites came under attack, including, you know, the website of the president, and I think the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. They were hacked, defaced, and they were DDoS'd, you know, so they basically overwhelmed the traffic. And what happened was no one really took much notice of this attack because there was no war yet, right? But after the war, cybersecurity experts, they kind of started looking through the record and said, hey, wait a second. There was a kind of an attack against just, you know, the public-facing website of several Georgian websites, government websites. There were, and they were attacked, overloaded with a string of characters that read, "From Russia with love," right? Or no, it said "with win love in Russia," and it was, and I think Russia was misspelled. But anyway, because, you know, Russians can't spell their own country's name, and so they said, "Oh, this is pretty clear," you know, the cybersecurity expert said. Well, this is just a kind of a warm-up exercise. What was going on here is the Russian intelligence services, right, were coordinating this. They were planning this attack. they were sort of doing a little bit of a feeler, you know? They were kind of testing out their capability, right? And so that became the fact that there was an attack before the war even erupted, right, became, you know, a central piece of evidence in the case against Russia and in the case for Russia's culpability and for Russia's this is something that they planned in advance, and this is an actual invasion of another country, right, of a sovereign nation. Mm-hmm. And so I was actually commissioned by Wired magazine to go down there at the time and to sort of figure out what was going on. And I went to Georgia, and I met with government officials. I met with, you know, people from Georgia's leading internet service providers. I met with people from different think tanks, met with Georgian hackers. And the evidence that I came away with at the time was that this is all bullshit. Hmm. And that no one really has any clear proof that Russia did it, as opposed to some kind of, you know, basically kind of nationalistic hackers or nationalistic script kiddies, because really the attacks really even weren't that sophisticated. You know, to hack and deface a website is not really that, there's nothing really that sophisticated about that, right. You know, mm-hmm. To basically replace Saakashvili's picture with a picture of Adolf Hitler, you know, on a website that had no real strategic importance to the Georgian government, was not really an act of war and actually didn't really help Russia in any way, you know, militarily, which is what was being claimed. And, you know, some of these cyber experts were saying that, you know, this is a new kind of nuclear warfare. You know, hacking and defacing Georgian websites by Russia was tantamount, was almost the same thing as Hiroshima. I mean, they were actually saying that. And so that we must take a military response to this, because this is a kind of a cyber terrorism, a cyber kind of nuclear attack. And yet none of the websites were important in any way to the Georgian society or to the Georgian government in any way. And so, you know, so I went down there and I could not find a shred of evidence. And even, you know, Georgia's hackers, who were kind of on Georgia's side and were, you know, told me tales of successfully hacking Russian websites and defacing them in the same way that Russian hackers defaced Georgian websites, and of launching successful attacks against RT that took the network down for a few hours. You know, they said that, no, I mean, come on, you know, like Russian hackers are pretty good, but what they're doing is just kind of for fun. You know, this is not a serious strike against the country. It's not a serious strike against Georgia's military. But that didn't stop in America from these cyber attacks being used as proof of Russia's culpability and of kind of inflaming an already dangerous situation, and inflaming it in such a way that could have led down a really, really, really kind of ugly road to war between two nuclear powers.
So, Yasha, as we wrap up here, let me return to the quote I made of Barack Obama from December, that he said, well, who are you going to believe, Russia or the U.S. intelligence community? And given what you've laid out for us here today, and I think you've done a good job of exposing these for-profit, these commercial cybersecurity firms like CrowdStrike, who can we believe? And, you know, what level of evidence do we need to see before we lay down our skepticism about these hysterical claims that have been circulating for months now?
We can't believe anyone. I mean, that's a sad reality of the times we live in, I think. I mean, of course, you can believe me, but no, I mean, look, in terms of do you believe our intelligence services or do you believe Russia? Well, you can't believe either, right? And, you know, the sad fact is we have very little evidence to go on, or there's very few people that are credible in this world that are left and that haven't been politicized and politicized into complete irrelevance in terms of credibility. I mean, that is the sad fact of today's of the world that we live in, is that there is really, it seems like, no one or very few people that we can trust, and it's definitely not the American intelligence agencies, and it's definitely not Russia. And that's a sad fact. I don't know. I mean, it really saddens me.
Well, my assignment is, before you finish your book, Surveillance Valley, we need a really neat happy ending to this story, and you're the one who's going to bring it to us, Yasha.
We're not going to get a happy ending. I'm sorry. You know, there's no happy endings here. Not in this world.
Well, Yasha, thanks for joining me again today. I highly recommend your piece at Baffler, From Russia with Panic, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to my in-depth interview with Yasha Levine. Your comments are always welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.